for cultivating progress across the South, for working to unconditionally improve the lives of all, and for the bold underwriting of every Gravy podcast. SFA thanks our visionary Louisville, Kentucky friends, Pam and Brooke Smith.
He exchanged letters with Gandhi.
He was friends with Henry Ford.
His life is the subject of an opera.
At the time of his death, his birthplace was designated a national monument, an honor at that point only reserved for presidents.
George Washington Carver's life and legacy defies easy explanation. And yet today, he is remembered by many as the peanut guy.
Perhaps with a side of sweet potatoes?
On today's episode of Gravy, producers Ishan Takor and Katie Jane Fernelius explore an often overlooked part of Carver's legacy, his embrace of sustainable agriculture to help Black Southern farmers, and what that legacy means for farmers who look to Carver today.
His campaign speaks to problems that we'll need to solve to have a sustainable future. His campaign revealed that you cannot separate social and environmental justice. It underscored that if you're going to have successful conservation plans, they have to account for the people living in them.
You're listening to Gravy.
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 A production of the Southern Foodways Alliance, Gravy tells the stories of the changing American South. I'm Marybeth Lassiter.
I'm Melissa Hall.
Ishan Takor reacquaints us with George Washington Carver.
There's this moment in George Washington Carver's life which elevated him to the heights of American fame. Think movie star famous. And it occurred, of all places, at a congressional hearing. In 1921, Carver appeared in front of a House committee as an expert witness on behalf of the peanut lobby, who wanted to secure a protective tariff on American peanuts. Here was a well-known and respected Black academic, facing questions by an all-white crowd.
He is greeted by racist quips about things like watermelons and the like. He's granted 10 minutes initially and begins giving this talk.
That's Mark Hersey. He's an environmental historian and an associate professor at Mississippi State University. He authored the book, My Work is That of Conservation, an environmental biography of George Washington Carver. At the time of the hearing, Carver led the agricultural department at the Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, which is in Macon County, Alabama. For years, Carver promoted dozens of different peanut uses to encourage Black farmers around Tuskegee to plant the crop. As he explained these uses to the committee, Carver drew the representatives to rapt attention.
The committee gives him unlimited time, and at the end of the day, they give him a standing ovation, which is pretty rare in Congress, I would imagine. This makes him a cultural celebrity.
Carver helped secure the peanut tariff, and seemingly overnight, Carver's fame became tied to the peanut. By the time of his death, according to Mark, Carver was the most admired and recognized Black man in all of America. But for Mark, Carver's blinding association with peanuts obscures a much more nuanced legacy. So, to tell a story about who George Washington Carver was, it's important to start with who he was not. Because the details that you, dear listener, might have heard about Carver, about the life he might have lived, get a little fuzzy. In fact, he's often credited with accomplishments that are more fiction than fact.
George Washington Carver is famous for inventing peanut butter, which didn't happen. He didn't really create any peanut products that were marketable or useful going forward.
Mark's scholarship argues that Carver should be remembered as a conservationist who fought for ideas that became the bedrock of environmentalism and sustainable agriculture. Ideas like understanding the importance of biodiversity for the health of the land, planting nitrogen-fixing crops, composting, and repurposing farm waste. Ideas that went against conventional wisdom at the time because they prioritized soil and plant health over pure profit and technical solutions.
His solution is to look backwards in an era when everyone else is looking towards increased yields, increased market participation, increased inputs.
By taking a holistic view of the land, Carver believed his methods would eventually free the most destitute farmers from the economic realities of the Jim Crow South.
The case for Carver as a conservationist is centered on his campaign to improve the lives of impoverished Black farmers in Macon County, Alabama.
But it was an uphill battle, to say the least.
His campaign ultimately foundered on the political realities of the Jim Crow South.
The fact that Carver tried at all to improve Black farmers' lives in such a hostile economic system is in and of itself remarkable. partly because of the improbable path that brought Carver to Tuskegee. Carver was born enslaved in the 1860s in Missouri. By the 1880s, he became the second Black student at Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa. That's where a mentor steered him away from studying painting, his true passion, to studying botany. So Carver transferred to the Iowa Agricultural College, now Iowa State, to study agriculture. As he settled in at Iowa, Carver wrote in letters that he viewed scientific agriculture as part of his Christian duty to help Black farmers in the South.
Now, he was trained under a guy named Lewis Pamel, who was a plant botanist. He was also the first man to write a book with the term ecology in its title.
Pamel was a pioneering ecologist at Iowa, and as his student, Carver was exposed to ecology's core principles well before they were formalized in textbooks. Pamel, Carver later wrote, influenced his life more than anyone else.
And so Carver was introduced to ecology as it was founding, as it was coalescing as a discipline.
Carver might have stayed at Iowa with Pamel were it not for an unexpected invitation from Booker T. Washington. It was an invitation that changed his life.
Who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land?
In 1895, Washington became hugely famous for this speech in Atlanta. The speech laid out the tenets of accommodationism, which basically said that Black Americans would tolerate segregation if they were allowed economic freedom. For the record, that idea was pretty controversial even then and would fall way out of favor during the Civil Rights Movement. But Washington, as the president of the Tuskegee Institute, sought to put accommodationism into practice.
And so this makes him the favorite of Northern philanthropists. It makes Booker T. Washington the most influential Black figure in America.
Washington saw Carver as a perfect choice to lead the newly formed agricultural department at Tuskegee and to retain an all-Black faculty. And Carver saw Tuskegee as a vehicle to bring his expert agricultural knowledge south. But things didn't quite go as planned. On a 1941 radio show, Carver reminisced about his train ride down to Tuskegee, about his heart sinking as he looked out the window. As he watched the landscape morph from golden wheat fields in the Midwest to monoculture cotton in the South, he saw, quote, "not much evidence of scientific farming anywhere. Everything looked hungry. The land, the cotton, the cattle, and the people."
Carver steps off the train in Macon County, Alabama, and looks around. And what he sees is eroded fields, and then what he says, acres of cotton, nothing but cotton. And this is a result, actually, of the rise of sharecropping and tenancy in the wake of the Civil War.
In the mid-1890s, cotton dominated the total crop acreage in Macon County. It was the cash crop. And that's because a majority of Black farmers who worked the land were sharecroppers. Farmers who didn't own their own land and often became trapped in a cycle of indebtedness to their landowner.
If you're farming on shares, the only thing that will get you cash and get you out of debt is cotton. It really becomes king in a way it hadn't been before the Civil War. And it's tended by people who have no incentive to take care of the soil at all. If they improve the soil, they're charged higher rents. At the end of the day, cotton expands, it's plowed, the cover crops go away, and soil exhaustion explodes throughout the South.
It's hard to overstate how exploitative this system was. Tenant farmers and sharecroppers might be charged as much as 100% interest to buy supplies at the beginning of a planting season, in a credit system completely controlled by white landowners and merchants. Landowners wanted to milk Macon County soils for as much productive cotton as possible, which meant Black farmers, at their direction, planted and tilled mainly cotton year after year. So it's within this landscape that Carver ran Tuskegee's agricultural experiment station. That meant answering questions and publishing research bulletins to help Black farmers in the area. When Carver first arrived at Tuskegee, his bulletins, in large part, mirrored the latest ag science. And that meant advocating for chemical fertilizers to maximize yields on the battered land.
He really shows up expecting to bring sort of Midwestern-style agriculture to the South, and that this will fix the problems. We're going to have technical solutions to these problems. Two-horse plows, chemically compounded fertilizers.
But over time, Carver's position shifted. He realized that the soil issues in Macon County were not a question of just inputs and outputs. Soil degradation was intrinsically tied to the economic demands of the Jim Crow South, which dictated how the land was managed.
They were stuck in a cycle of dependence and debt because they were such a precarious position socially, economically, and politically.
So Carver's research bulletin started to zig where ag science at the time zagged. If farmers could grow their own food, Carver thought, or acquire their own supplies, they'd fall less into debt and become less dependent on white owners. In his writing, Carver began to downplay the use of chemical fertilizers, which in the early 20th century were almost sacrosanct to farming.
Chemical fertilizers cost money that white landlords wouldn't advance to black tenants, and which black tenants generally didn't have. But what was available was swamp muck. And you can compost that, and you can apply that, and that will both slow erosion by creating a better topsoil, even as it provides the necessary nutrients that plants would need.
Carver wrote about using swamp muck as a free alternative to commercial fertilizer. In bulletins, he pushed for vegetable gardens, manure composting, and different plowing techniques. He enlisted staff to take a wagon out to the countryside and give practical demonstrations. And it was his search for low-cost solutions which brought Carver to a hardy, not yet so popular legume.
What he begins looking for are crops that can be grown alongside cotton, that the cultivation doesn't overlap in the same kind of way, but that are nutritious or high calorie, and so much better if they're nitrogen fixing. And that's how he got to the peanut.
The peanut, a leguminous vegetable, fixes nitrogen from the air back into the soil, replenishing it. Carver reached similar conclusions about sweet potatoes and cowpeas, which he also enthusiastically promoted in bulletins. Carver wrote about, but did not invent, various peanut recipes and uses, meant to encourage black farmers to grow their own peanuts for use as food and supplies. So when the peanut lobby came knocking, Carver's peanut bulletins paved the way for his expert testimony to Congress. But when the floodgates of fame opened afterwards, people papered over his other conservation work. His typecasting as the Peanut Man would encase him, a mythology as thick and sticky as a tub of crunchy peanut butter.
When we come back, we'll hear more about how people thought about Carver during his lifetime and where his legacy stands today, in a different time and much different socio-political reality. But first,
Gravy has some big news for Dolly Parton fans. Lodge Cast Iron has launched a new collection of Dolly Parton cast iron. Inspired by the one and only Tennessee icon, each of the four cookware pieces brings a bit of Dolly flair to your favorite Southern dishes. Just like Dolly, cast iron is made in Tennessee and loved all over the world. Made with just iron and oil, the naturally seasoned cooking surface on a Lodge pan is made to last for generations, so you'll never have to change your tune. Take home the new Lodge Cast Iron Dolly Parton collection and shop cookware born to perform at LodgeCastIron.com. For Lodge's longtime support of the Southern Foodways Alliance and this podcast, we thank them.
So yeah, these are a couple of raised beds, and right now we have some zinnias and sunflowers, which the birds love, and we also have some sweet potatoes that we got growing in that raised bed, and then I can take you over to this side.
Nick Speed has close-cropped hair, a wide smile, and is wearing a gray hoodie that has a stylized, very cool portrait of George Washington Carver on it. Nick runs the George Washington Carver Farms in St. Louis, Missouri, as well as a community garden, all under the umbrella of his nonprofit. GWC Farms is a compact half-acre urban farm that seeks to honor Carver's legacy beyond just the peanut.
Carver came across my radar as an outdoor educator. He did a phenomenal job of really creating opportunities for black farmers in the South, to creating manuals for folks who are experiencing food insecurity to find edible plants that you would see in a park or in an open field, and gets left out when we talk about Carver's legacy.
For Nick as a farmer, just like with Mark, the Carver scholar, talking about Carver's legacy means thinking about him as a conservationist, backed by the ideas he promoted at Tuskegee. Carver's solutions cost practically no money and relied on the natural world. Reading his bulletins now in his archives, they seem remarkably simple, foolproof in a way.
What he was trying to do is get the farmers to develop a way of thinking rather than a prescription. They needed to learn to think ecologically, and by seeing the connections between soil and animals and plants, wherever they had seen weeds, they would suddenly see food.
But the actual results of Carver's campaign? Well, it wouldn't be a stretch to call them a failure, at least in his lifetime. Black land ownership rates in Macon County were lower in the 1930s than they were in 1910, when Carver was at Tuskegee. The birth of a large, self-sufficient Black farming class never materialized in Alabama. And there are lots of reasons for this. But one stands out in particular.
It was a sound plan in theory, right? It was a sound plan ecologically, but a commitment to white supremacy made it just impossible.
Carver's mission, if it had succeeded, would have been deeply subversive to the Jim Crow South. Carver operated in a system where landlords and merchants controlled all the means of production, from the credit to buy farm supplies to the cotton mills. Landlords and creditors told Black farmers what to plant, which limited opportunities to diversify crops or rotate other crops in. For Carver to have succeeded in both repairing the soil and uplifting Black farmers would have meant toppling an entire political system. It would have meant battling economic forces like farm mechanization, which began displacing Black farmers in waves of migration north. And doing all of that was just too much for one man with one experimental agricultural station.
His campaign revealed was that you cannot separate social and environmental justice. It underscored that if you're going to have successful conservation plans, they have to account for the people living in them.
So should we consider Carver's work as a failure then? For Mark, it's an unequivocal no. Carver's sustainable agricultural ideas were decades ahead of their time. Years before ecologist Aldo Leopold penned his famous land ethic, basically, what's good for the land is what's good for the land, Carver tried to put those ideas in practice when every major economic, social, and political force was working against Black people. And he tried to work within the means of the people around him.
The things he fought for, though, are really worthwhile, really important. And the way he approached those was pretty ingenious.
Even Carver may have realized that his efforts may not bear fruit until much later. Here's him in a 1939 interview, discussing his work at Tuskegee in a poetic, almost foreshadowing way.
Sometimes it is wise not to look for too much appreciation. The main thing is to be sure you're right and go ahead, regardless of whether people appreciate it or whether they don't. Because in time, they will appreciate it. So simply be sure that you are on the right road.
Carver's approach to biodiversity is a legacy that Mark, Nick, and now I see in Carver. When I first met Nick, I thought observing Carver's legacy in practice would mean talking about the nuts and bolts of composting or fertilizer. But Carver's legacy at Nick's farm is much more about seeing and responding to the economic problems specific to the neighborhood.
We are in Fairground neighborhood, a historic North St. Louis City neighborhood, one that was once thriving but is now littered with vacant properties, vacant buildings, crime, unemployment.
Getting the farm off the ground meant buying the property, which is a familiar hurdle for Black farmers. For Nick, owning the land itself was important to the sustainability of his operation and a way to challenge the status quo.
The USDA has had a history of discrimination against Black folks trying to get loans, resources, land to farm specifically, while simultaneously creating those same opportunities for white men and their families.
Carver died before the civil rights movement overturned Jim Crow laws, but its shadow lived on. For decades, the USDA denied Black farmers loans and credit worth billions of dollars. After several lawsuits, Black farmers eventually won one of the largest civil rights settlements in U.S. history. But in 1999, and at that point, the damage was already done. Today, agriculture, in all of the U.S., but especially in the South, is white-dominated and largely composed of big agribusiness.
Less than 2% of all farmers in this country are Black. As a Black farmer, for you to not just commit to a career in urban agriculture, but to purchase and manage land, I think in itself is a defiance against white supremacy and the systems that have for so long kept us from these opportunities.
With the deed in hand, Nick ramped up the farm slowly. It's now in year two. Nick told me that once it reaches full capacity, this half acre alone can easily yield 20,000 pounds of food a year. And traces of Carver's sustainable agricultural vision are everywhere. There's composting, repurposed wooden benches as plant beds, and companion planting, or putting complementary crops together. And Nick showed me a patch of strawberries under a tree sapling, across from a bright yellow sunflower patch.
The strawberries grow out in a horizontal fashion, similar to sweet potatoes. And so as they continue to grow, they provide ground cover around the fruit trees and help keep weeds and other grasses from popping up. Sunflowers are things that we're currently growing that help repair the soil. And so we are just really intentional about not just growing food for people, but also growing food for pollinators and creating a rich habitat.
GWC Farms is not just a farm, which is an acknowledgement by Nick that supporting his community means addressing its socioeconomic reality. Like Carver, it means thinking about who the farm is serving. Nick's nonprofit runs the Sunflower Institute to introduce teens to agriculture and food career paths. And there are other projects in the works.
The biggest way to support our communities is through agriculture. Through our expansion of food production, we're going to have more job opportunities. Through the education, we're going to open up career paths for folks who wouldn't have access to those. By building green infrastructure, we're literally making these communities healthier and safer for the folks living in these spaces.
Looking out at the farm, it was mostly empty. But where I saw dirt and patchy grass, Nick saw endless possibilities of fish ponds, rain catchment sprinklers, and more fruit trees.
We'll have a larger gazebo for cover space. This is the beginning of our orchard. We have 5 fruit trees currently, 4 pears, 1 persimmon.
He saw solutions that were good for the land and the people living around it. And that seems like something worth fighting for.
Ishan Takor reported this episode. Together, he and Katie Jane Fernelius produced it. Ishan is a multimedia producer and investigative journalist based in Colorado, where he is a Ted Scripps Fellow in Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
We thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music, Jazar for our donor music. We also owe a huge thank you to Clay Jones and Broadcast Studios for recording and mixing Gravy. These days, when we pour Gravy in your ear, it sounds better than ever thanks to Clay.
Managing editor for Gravy and all other SFA media is Sarah Camp Milam. Olivia Terenzio is our podcast editor. My co-host, Mary Beth Lassiter, is our publisher.
Want to learn more about the changing American South? Visit us at southernfoodways.org. Read oral histories, watch films, or listen to this podcast. While you're there, become a member or make a donation. Your dollars fund our work and help us make more gravy. I'm Mary Beth Lassiter.
I'm Melissa Hall. Excited to lap up another episode of Gravy? Tell a friend.
Pass the gravy boat. There's plenty to go around.
Gravy is proud to be a part of APT Podcast Studios.